of the contract, which is the patent assignment, and that appears at page 4048 of the appendix. It's paragraph 9 of the sub-R&D agreement, and the court may wish to reference that as I proceed. The introductory phrase is very important in that patent assignment. It says, on behalf of the partnership, the developer, in this case Intergata, shall apply for and obtain patents. That means the assignment has to be interpreted for the benefit of the partnership. And the key to that interpretation is to take into account the essence of the deal, which was IBEP would provide research money in return for the research results, including commercial products. To be sure, IBEP gave Intergata an option to purchase these discoveries, but that option was not exercised here, and that is not really an issue before the court. So if we start with the contract, with the assignment language, the assignment covers patents on all inventions resulting from the R&D programs, and then goes on to say, and such patents that form part of the proprietary information are assigned to IBEP. Certainly, Claim 1 of the 701 patent forms a part of the proprietary information. It covers TBP, which was discovered...
Can I just stop you here?
Yes, sir.
I see it the other way around. I mean, isn't it, in this case, the proprietary information forms part of the patent, not the other way around?
Well, I mean, I think either way, it still falls within the terms of the contract, because if a patent includes proprietary information, that is, as one of the claims, then the patent forms a part of the proprietary information.
I mean, that's the step you lose me at. I guess I'm having a hard time seeing where anything in the agreement that you've referenced in your response or so forth gets you to that point, that you own... If there's a piece of proprietary information in any patent, that gives you exclusive ownership of the entire patent. Right. Which is the language that you say gives you that?
If you look at the definition of proprietary information, which I believe is at 4043 of the appendix, it includes both patents and inventions. And so, if there is an invention that forms a part of the proprietary information.
Right.
And that invention is in a patent.
Right.
The patent then forms a part of the proprietary information.
And that's based on the definition?
Of proprietary information, which includes patents.
But it doesn't say patents in which you have one invention. I mean, it lists a series of things that it could mean. And of course, proprietary information could cover patents, but why does that dispose of the question? I mean, that could mean patents in which, you know, all the discoveries, all the claims had come to fruition under the, you know, in 1987 or before. Where are you getting?
Because the essence of the agreement was to ensure that the partnership take ownership of the proprietary information in whatever form, whether it be in an invention or whether it be in a claim as part of the patent. I mean, that was the deal.
But in a way, wasn't it a bad deal, because you gave IATA the discretion to apply for patents. I think that's the actual term is discretion. So they had the right to aggregate different inventions together.
Well, certainly they had to do it on behalf of the partnership, and Intergata then made the decision to include, for the benefit of the partnership, claims 2 and 3 in the 701 patent, and from that one can infer that Intergata concluded that those claims resulted from R&D programs.
Isn't that too big a leap? I mean, in a way, you get more than you actually contributed. Theoretically, some of the inventions came afterwards, so you get a little bit more, but also you don't get the exclusivity.
But the inventions... and the inventions we're talking about here were purely for commercialization of the discovery. And according to the POM, the private offering memorandum, I mean, that's what we were buying.
No, it was a purification. It was, one was a partial purification, and was it Rubenstein?
Yes, Rubenstein contributed.
In other words, he had the purification process, so he gave an inventive contribution. So he gets the patent, you get the patent, you just don't get it exclusively.
No, first of all, he doesn't get the patent.
Well, I mean, because, well, right, it goes up through.
Yeah, it goes into Yale.
Fair enough. Right. But still, it's not exclusive to you, because you only get what you bargained for.
Which was the inventions resulting from the R&D programs. There would not
leaving
have been aside the science invention.
Wait a minute.
Well, leaving
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Did you raise the result? I mean, I looked in your answer to the summary judgment motion on just the issue of resulting from, not the other issues you've talked about today, and I didn't see that you had raised that issue before the district court.
In fact, we submitted the affidavit of Mr. Becker, and Mr. Becker's affidavit at the appendix at 4392 says he contributed seed money. His understanding was IBEP would own scientific discoveries, including patents and commercial products resulting from those discoveries.
Well, but let's go to the language of the agreements. If I recall correctly, I think the resulting from language is only in the agreement that gives an interest in the proceeds of any patent as opposed to ownership. Isn't that correct?
No, Your Honor.
Where's the language?
I believe it's in paragraph 9A of the sub-R&D agreement, and it says, on behalf of the partnership, developers shall apply for and obtain patents in developer and variator's names on all inventions resulting from the R&D program.
Okay, but
there's nothing about revenues or just money.
Right, but that's tied in turn to the proprietary information, correct?
Well, yes. Such patents that form a part of the proprietary information.
Now, I mean, clarify this for me. If I understand it correctly, if IBEP invests $1 million in the project and subsequently someone else invests $1 million in the project after IBEP's termination of its investment period, and something comes out of the $2 million investment, then you get an interest in the proceeds of that of whatever intellectual property comes out of that agreement, right?
Only after the option to purchase has been exercised. Then we get our revenues.
All right.
But that's the only way we get our revenues.
Okay, but that is different from, as I understand it, the provisions that deal with your proprietary interest in the patent.
Right.
In other words,
that's correct.
What's difficult about this case is that the main work, presumably, at least it feels this way, that was during the period in which you were involved. And suppose that you had been involved only at the very outset for a very short period of time, just enough so that one out of 12 inventors you could claim, you could point to as your guy, would you then have, on your theory, exclusive ownership of the entire patent? And if not, why not, under your theory?
Well, if I understand the question.
Yeah, it was a rather convoluted question, I'm sorry. But you understand, I think. Well, go ahead, take a shot at it, and I'll see.
If there were a number of inventors involved in research during our time period, and they came up with a discovery, whatever that discovery was, we would own that discovery.
Well, my question is, what would be your interest in, suppose that that discovery was enough to give you some interest in the patent, but the whole patent involved many more people with much more by way of discoveries and inventions that occurred after your tenure in the investment. Would you then have a claim to the entire patent?
Well,
and if not, why not under your theory?
First of all, whether we would or not is a question of fact to the jury. The jury would have
okay,
to decide.
Okay, all right. But I'm going to what I really want to know is, why wouldn't you, on those facts, given your theory of the case, have a right to the entire patent? Or do you think you would?
Well, again, if the work that was done subsequent to our discovery resulted from the R&D programs, we would have that right. And the work that's contemplated is work for commercialization. To bring
even though it was not, even though it was not developed in the R&D program, that is to say, when you were there. So, because I'm positing all sorts of inventions that, sure, they emerged from the R&D program, but they were entirely separate inventions done long after you left the program. Do you still get them under your theory?
Again, I think that that is a question of fact for the jury. I don't think that that's
should be
decided here, and I think
but that's a question of fact, and the operative fact being, did they result from the initial?
Here, what we have is a series of purification steps performed during the sub R&D agreement, which Wallach, the leader of the project, says basically taught us a great deal about TBP, and helped us enrich TBP through various purification steps, and what Rubinstein did basically was a direct sequel that resulted from the R&D program. So here, that question of fact resolves in our favor. With respect to Judge Bryson's question of fact, again, that would be a question for the jury. If it's really attenuated, if it has nothing to do with commercialization of that initial discovery, then we probably aren't, we don't have any claim to it.
But it would turn entirely, as Judge Prost said, on resulting from. So if the conclusion was resulting from, then it wouldn't matter that it was not developed in the R&D programs, which is the definition of proprietary information.
No, resulting
something
from and
you
developed
can
in are basically synonymous terms. No,
well,
there's not a great deal of
difference there.
It's
a clarification. Resulting from, something can result from a program which somebody began 5 years ago and then left, but that person's involvement may have terminated 5 years ago, and that is not then developed in the R&D programs. The R&D programs defined as the period in which that person was involved, correct?
Well, that depends on what was developed in the R&D programs, and if there were a series of purification steps which then Rubinstein added to marginally, then I think the question for the jury is, was it developed in?
So you're essentially challenging his naming as an inventor. You're challenging inventorship.
No, I'm not. I'm not challenging him as an inventor. I am simply saying that his work simply built on the process that was started and continued during the sub-R&D agreement, and that qualifies as developed in.
So you have some contract terms that say developed, I think, in the R&D program, and then you have some language saying resulting from, and what you're urging us to do is to look at this packet of contracts and say that as long as it began during R&D, you get the rights to it.
What I'm saying is that resulting from, inventions that result from the R&D programs under this assignment, are proprietary information. And even if they're not.
It doesn't say that when it defines proprietary information. Of course, you have to go to another contract to get that.
No, I think the proprietary information basically talks about inventions and patents developed
in the R&D program.
And then the question becomes, what does developed in mean? And building on purification steps that were developed during our sub-R&D research period, certainly contributed mightily to what Rubinstein eventually came up with. And all of that then is thrown into the 701 patent, both the earlier purification steps as well as the later.
But doesn't that, what's that TOS, is that TOS? I don't know what you're calling it.
Yes,
doesn't that then deal with the subsequent stages and give you certain rights afterwards? Because acknowledging that the research was going to continue.
Here's what the TOS does, and I think what's really important is to look at the language of the option that the Intergata had in the TOS. And what it says is that Intergata is entitled to proprietary information relating to products that are reduced to practice. Okay? That's the scope, which is similar to resulting from, because reduced to practice is defined. It's defined in the TOS agreement as products. In fact, products that are ready for industrial scale-up. So that is a very broad option to exercise. And it mirrors the assignment, which IBEP basically, under that assignment, owns. That is the commercialization part of a discovery. I mean, after all, that was the deal. I mean, we didn't go in there to fund a university. We went in there because we wanted commercial products. And if these folks are going to continue to commercialize, then we get that product.
What if Mr. Rubenstein had worked for someone other than Intergeta?
Different situation, Judge.
Because?
Because under Israeli law, Dr. Rubenstein worked for Intergeta, and his work basically passed by operation of law to Intergeta, and then by assignment to IBEP. But if he's working for somebody else, it doesn't pass to Intergeta, and then it doesn't pass by assignment to IBEP. So that's a really important point. I mean, he has to work for Intergeta. They admit he does. That was not disputed in the court below. They try to raise some issues now, but you know, frankly, we didn't have any
burden.
Okay,
let me ask you another. What if he had been hired by Intergeta after 1987? So he wasn't an employee during 1987. Different result?
No, I think that the future rights to the 701 patent had been assigned at the time of the signing of the sub-R&D agreement. And as long as Intergeta had all of those rights, and they had to have all those rights, they could then assign all of those rights to IBEP.
Very well. We'll restore your rebuttal time, or at least we'll give you a couple of minutes, depending on how much we appear to need. Let's see now. Mr. Groomridge, you were going to go first, and you have 12 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good afternoon. What I want to start off with is by saying there's no dispute here that Rubenstein made an invention, and he made it after the sub-R&D agreement had expired. Right? And the operative grant language of proprietary rights in the sub-R&D agreement and its companion, the TOS agreement, says the only thing that's granted is stuff that's developed in the R&D program.
And what about the language resulting?
Absolutely. That's not a grant. And let's absolutely look at that. If we look at 4048 on the record, right, what it says, it talks about patents, and interestingly enough in the outset, it's a different part of the agreement than property rights, which appears on the next page. Right? The granting of property rights is in a separate section on the next page. Right? Which section? It explicitly uses the definition of proprietary information, which again refers back to developed in the R&D programs. What this section that the appellant is apparently now basing its entire argument on, 9A, says is that the developer, Intergeta, has an obligation to do certain things. During the term of this agreement, the developer, Intergeta, is obliged to at least exercise good faith discretion in deciding whether to apply for patents. And the broad category of patents as to which that obligation applies is patents on inventions resulting from. Right? That's not a grant. That's saying that's an obligation imposed upon Intergeta, the developer. And then it follows on for clarification, which they do in all of these agreements pretty much whenever they talk about patents, to say, provided however, and that second clause of 9A, provided however clause, is the one that is, if anything, an assignment here. The first clause with the language resulting from is absolutely not an assignment. And when we look at the part of this that is arguably an assignment, the provided however clause, it says, as they always do over and over again in these agreements, it refers only to things that form a part of the proprietary information. In other words, that maps back to the same set of definitions, things that are developed in the R&D program. And it's totally simple, it's totally undisputed, it was undisputed below. Rubenstein's contribution was not developed in the R&D program, and therefore it's not proprietary information. And they don't get it. Now, Mr. Hanlon said it was very important and illustrative to look at the language of the option in the so-called TOS agreement, and I agree with that, I absolutely agree with that. And that language appears in the record, Your Honours, at page 4209, if memory serves. And it's section 5 of the TOS agreement. And what it's, and the purpose of this, the reason this is important, is because Integer, the developer, wants and indeed needs to have a mechanism to obtain from IBAP everything that IBAP has got. Why is that? Because Integer has in turn promised that it will deliver everything back to YEDA, a separate organization. And that is found in the YEDA agreement, which is also in the record, and should the court get a look, it's at 4069 and 4070, particularly 4069. And what this option says, and interestingly, this option doesn't just relate to products reduced to practice. Reduced to practice, by the way, is its own special definition, which, separate apart from the normal patent law definition. It says, in respect of which a patent application has been filed prior to the expiration or termination of the sub-R&D agreement. So, to the extent it talks about patents, the option talks just about ones that were filed before December 1987 when the sub-R&D agreement expired. It doesn't talk about ones like the application at issue in this case that were filed after that date. Why is that? Because a separate part of the TOS agreement deals with applications like this one that were filed after the expiration of the sub-R&D agreement. That is section 9B of the TOS agreement in the record at page 4214. And that says, if we have a patent application filed after the sub-R&D agreement is expired, IBAP can qualify for royalties. The royalties will be diluted, and Judge Bryson, for example, in the court's hypothetical,
you get half.
You get half, right? It doesn't give them ownership. Why does it not give them ownership? Because it's not consistent with their having ownership. If they had ownership, they wouldn't need
they
a separate provision to be paid here. And the reason this provision is in there is because the way the parties contemplated this whole deal, patent application filed after the termination of the sub-R&D agreement would never pass to the partnership, to IBAP. It would never belong to IBAP. And to the extent that they might embody some information that had been developed on IBAP's nickel, if you will, that information would fall within the bucket that the agreement's called residual proprietary information. And there is an option to purchase that. So you would then reunify all of the ownership back in the Integer, and there would be to the extent that the residual proprietary information had been baked into a patent application or merged, there would be a royalty obligation with the appropriate dilution provisions to take account of who had contributed what. And that was the regime.
What's the relevance of Section 10, the property rights provision under A, which talks about future, you know, all persons employed by it presently in the future? What is the relevance of that provision to what we're
doing? I think that's the basic grant provision in the sub-R&D agreement. I think Section 9 is not the grant provision. It includes this assignment only for avoidance of doubt. But the fundamental provision that's conveying rights is Section 10. That's why it's their property rights. And that's what it's saying. This partnership, right, that this is what should be it. To follow up on a couple of other points, and I'm not sure how I'm doing on time.
You're fine.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Insofar as the question of resulting from was it raised below, it was not raised. Your Honor, it's certainly possible to scour the briefs below that argument wasn't raised. We are not standing here suggesting that the appellee should prevail on this because it wasn't raised below, although that may be a valid outcome. But it certainly wasn't raised below, and we submit it's not fair to the district court to fault the district court for not having addressed an argument that was never put in front of it. With respect to Rubenstein and who he worked for, again, that issue is potentially in play. When we moved below, did not make it the focal point of our argument because we proceeded on the basis that the grant of rights is only to things that are developed during the R&D programs, and since he made this invention after the R&D programs were over, it didn't matter who he worked for. But if we're going to look at these new arguments that have been raised by IBAP now on appeal, one of the things that was striking to us when we looked at IBAP's briefs in this case is that they're virtually devoid of references to what the district court did. They are now, therefore, wholly new arguments. If we look at those arguments, one of them that they make is a sort of aggregation argument where they say, well, even if we didn't get Rubenstein's piece because it didn't result from, or didn't come up and it wasn't made in the R&D programs, we got it later on when it was incorporated into a patent, which also included some things that were created in the R&D programs. And that's a new argument, right? But if you're going to look at that argument, then it becomes fundamentally important to trace the chain of title of Rubenstein's interest. Right? And so it raises not just the question of when that was created, but also where did it go once it was created. And what happened, and if we're going to look at that, what we see here is, as a matter of undisputed fact, Rubenstein was working two jobs at the relevant time. Yes, it is certainly true that he was working for Inter Yeda. He was also simultaneously continuing in his job as a professor at the Weizmann
Institute. Wait, are you talking before the expiration in 87?
He actually assumed his job. He worked full-time at the Weizmann Institute before the expiration and until about September of 87. And then he began to split his time, so there's a short overlap of a few months when he was splitting his time. Then the sub-R&D agreement expired, and he continued to split his time after that.
So I'm confused what you're doing. You're telling us pieces of the record now that would defeat a resulting from argument?
They would defeat an aggregation argument by saying that Rubenstein's piece, even if it was separately owned, once it got folded into this patent application, because the patent application also included something else that belonged to IBEC, ipso facto, everything in the patent application then belonged to IBEC.
But that's different than the resulting.
That is different from the resulting from argument. Yes, that's what I would categorize as an aggregation argument, saying even if we don't win on resulting from, we still win because you took, even if this was, let's assume hypothetically, you could have filed a separate patent application and you people would have owned that. But when you didn't, and you took it and you put the two things together, we got the lot. Right? And I would call that an aggregation argument. I would say that that appears to be at least some part of what IBEC is arguing now. It wasn't argued below, but to the extent that they are making that argument, there's a fatal flaw in it. Namely, there's no good chain of title of Rubenstein's interests here, that because he worked two jobs, and so you would have to know in which capacity he was working when he made this invention, and the record is silent on that. Had it been raised below, the record would have been fleshed out, but it wasn't. And second of all, if you look at the nature of the relationship between Yeda and Inter Yeda, and I apologize, Your Honor, for the confusing nature of these, but they are two separate entities.
We've been through this once, but at least two-thirds of us have been through this once before, so we're beginning to get the gist of it.
Many of us on this side of the bench have also been through it, Your Honor.
Just about all the place.
But if we look, for example, at in the record at page 4069, the so-called Yeda agreement between Yeda and Inter Yeda, in the section that deals with ownership there, it talks about property rights. When the sub-R&D agreement is terminated, property rights to anything that happens after that will be vested in Yeda, not Inter Yeda. And therefore, had this issue been properly raised and ventilated in the district court, what we would see is, in fact, Rubenstein's interest never passed to Inter Yeda. And in fact, this patent application was not filed by Inter Yeda.
Why would we even get into all of this?
I hope you would not, Your Honor. But the reason would be because IBEC raises it now in appeal. This is the aggregation argument, yeah.
Speaking of the prior appeal, I think this may have come up there too. I mean, both briefs are marked confidential, and I didn't ask the other counsel about it. I mean, this is all stuff that happened, you know, close to 20 years ago. What is the basis for the markings of confidentiality here?
I can speak only on behalf of my client, Your Honor, but the only thing that my client would consider confidential is there is some much more recent information, a very little smattering of it, about how these inventors divided up the royalties amongst themselves.
That doesn't sound like it's likely to come up.
As far as my client is concerned, other than that, there's absolutely nothing in this record.
And that is reflected in the markings you had in the confidential brief, or that's your view now?
That's my client's view now.
Okay, well, my question goes to the markings in the confidential brief and whether they're necessary. So are you prepared to say whether they are limited to what your position is now on the combine?
From the standpoint of Yetta, anything other than that can freely be disseminated to the public. The only reason for that concern is that it's maybe a privacy issue for the individual.
Yours are fewer. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll inquire of the other counsel if that's okay.
I'm happy to answer any other questions the court may have, but that will conclude my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Green.
Thank you.
Ms. Rudolph.
Please report. I'll try to keep my remarks brief. I just have 2 points, and then I'll answer your question about the confidential nature as well. I first want to start with stepping back a little bit and looking at the nature of the relationship between these two parties, IBEP or IBEP and InterYeda, and how is that relationship defined? That relationship is defined by two contracts, the sub-R&D contract and the TOS agreement. The sub-R&D contract is a limited term contract. It's only 5 years. The other agreement, the TOS agreement, is longer. So the parties contemplated that someone would be doing additional research. And in fact, there's a right of first refusal in the TOS agreement if IBEP wanted to fund that additional research. But the point is that the patent assignment and the proprietary information that is developed in the sub-R&D agreement, that governs what they own. There's a clear intent here that they are only providing funding for 5 years, and they get research results for 5 years, and that's it. And anything that is developed during that 5-year term, they own. But that contract then ends. The TOS agreement then, which extends farther in length, then governs the relationship with the parties going forward based on the results that had been obtained in the 5 years. So if you look at the Section 13, for example, of the TOS agreement, it's very clear that what they're saying is IBEP only gets the proprietary information developed during the sub-R&D agreement, and that's expressly set forth in the contract. And there are other provisions that Mr. Groombridge mentioned that support that idea that all IBEP is entitled to is what was developed during the term of the sub-R&D agreement. The second point I wanted to raise was to clarify something that IBEP has raised in its brief, although he didn't really expressly discuss it here. And that is, in order to fit the entire 701 patent within the framework of the sub-R&D agreement, IBEP has argued that the appellees don't dispute that TBP, whatever that means, was discovered no later than 1987. And that statement's just not accurate. They're using that term TBP to cover everything that's in the 701 patent and obscuring the difference between the subject matter of claims 2 and 3 versus what was claimed in claim 1. And the subject matter of claims 2 and 3 is indisputably a different invention because it has a different inventive entity. And just to, the nomenclature can be a little confusing. I just want to take a minute to go through that. In 1987, the original three inventors discovered something in urine that binds TNF, and they called it TBP, TNF binding protein. At that time, they didn't know how many proteins were in urine that were exhibiting that activity. In 1988, Dr. Rubinstein started working on the project, and thanks to Dr. Rubinstein, they were able to substantially purify and partially sequence a particular protein that had that activity. Now, at that time, they did not realize that there was more than one protein in urine that would have a similar activity of binding TNF, so they continued to call it TBP. Later, they discovered that there was a second protein, and at that point, they renamed the original protein TBP1, and they called the second protein TBP2. So the point to keep in mind is that whatever you call it, that the inventors did not have the subject matter of claims 2 and 3, the substantially purified, partially sequenced protein that's claimed in claims 2 and 3 until 1988.
But if you took the resulting from tests, though, would there be enough information in the record to send it back for trial?
No, there should be no, there's no dispute that what they, or there should be no dispute, it's very clear from the undisputed facts, if you look at these contracts, that resulting from cannot mean an invention that was created wholly outside of the sub-R&D agreement. The language of the contract is clear. It's limited to proprietary information. Proprietary information is developed in the sub-R&D agreement, and proprietary information is the phrase that limits that assignment. So resulting from cannot capture inventions that were made after the
term. So you would say it wasn't a causation.
Pardon me?
Something that flowed from the original invention, flowed into these other inventions, you would say not to interpret it that way.
That's correct. And if you look at the TOS agreement, that's the only way you can interpret it, namely to mean not resulting from in the way that Mr. Hamlin would argue. What the TOS agreement contemplates is shared royalties. There's a right of first refusal for going forward with additional R&D. If they refuse to provide funding, then a third party can step in. So basically, no matter how you look at that contract, there's no way it can capture a later invention. Since you can't capture the later invention from which Dr. Rubenstein had an inventive contribution, they cannot lay claim to his inventive contribution, and they cannot lay claim to sole ownership of the patent.
Very well, thank you.
And your point on the confidential markings?
There's no Amgen or Y confidential information in the appendix, so from our point of view, there's nothing that would need to remain confidential.
Now, I guess we have another group of parties, unfortunately, we have a lot of parties here, and there's another group of parties that did not file a separate brief, but
everyone is represented here in court today, Your Honor.
Fine. So your representations are, or perhaps someone else can make a representation with respect to the Interlab Serrano parties, with respect now only as to the problem of confidential information.
Yes, Your Honor, Wayne Barsley, Houston Dunn Crutcher, on behalf of Interdata and Serrano interveners in this matter. If I may have 30 seconds.
Of course, why don't you approach the lectern so that your comments can be recorded?
I shall.
This is one of those nightmares we have where you get called out of the audience to argue.
It's a pop quiz.
All right. Wait till we start asking questions.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. On behalf of Serrano and Interdata, interveners in this action, we don't have any objection to any of the information in any of the briefs being released publicly.
Very well.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And now I guess both your rebuttal and also if I forget it, I guess just Bruce will remind me, but we also want to hear your views as to the confidential materials problem.
First, as to the confidential materials, I completely agree with the comments of Judge Brooks. This material is over 20 years old.
Okay.
I don't believe it's confidential.
Okay, I think we have a good idea of what the parameters are on our commission to refer to things that may be marked but have not been asserted as important to protect. So go ahead. Why don't we give you 3 minutes?
First of all, I want to once again refer to the option to purchase in the TOS agreement. But before I do that, I want to make it clear that the TOS agreement essentially only triggers if the option to purchase is exercised. That is, all the subsequent paragraphs after paragraph 5 really have no relevance because the option was never exercised. But Mr. Groombridge made a few comments about the scope of the option, and he talked about how it actually covers patent applications which have been filed prior to the expiration or termination of the sub-R&D agreement. But those only refer to residual proprietary information. This is on page 4209. I was referring to the option to purchase in paragraph 5A that says The partnership hereby grants Inter IATA the option to purchase all the partnership's rights, title, and interest in and to the proprietary information relating to each product that has been reduced to practice. Okay? That's the scope of the option to purchase that Inter IATA has. So obviously then, that
sentence, just for clarification, or it doesn't. The sentence doesn't add end there.
No.
It continues.
But that deals with a different situation involving residual proprietary information. You see?
Okay. Well.
It says, or in respect to which a patent application has been filed to the expiration or termination of the sub-RME agreement,
okay,
and to residual proprietary information.
Okay.
So. That's really not at issue here.
Okay.
The only issue is whether or not the scope of the patent assignment in the sub-R&D agreement mirrors the option to purchase. And it clearly does, because it looks at essentially what happens in order to commercialize the product, because reduced to practice is defined on page 4207, and it talks about the product being produced. Right? So the idea was that IBEP would own all of the inventions relating to, resulting from the R&D programs, including commercialization, which included purification. Rubinstein said that. He was very clear about that. And then Inter IATA would have an option to purchase those discoveries. I mean, there's perfect symmetry here. Right? And what they're trying to do is basically just cut off discoveries as if this was some academic institution that we were funding. And that's simply not the case. Also, we have evidence in the record to show how important the work done on purification was during the sub-R&D agreement. I mean, Dr. Engelman himself testified that he worked in 1987 and 1988 with both Dr. Wallach and Dr. Rubinstein in order to purify TBP. I mean, this clearly was a continuum, a process that they were building upon in order to commercialize discoveries owned by IBEP. And that really was the gist of the agreement. Now, referring again to the sub-R&D agreement, again, Mr. Groombridge just started by saying, well, the first part isn't a grant. And then he says, well, it's just Inter IATA shall apply for and obtain patents. That introductory phrase, on behalf of the partnership, is really important, because it really lays out how that assignment has to be interpreted. And it has to be interpreted for the benefit of IBEP. And it has to take into account that without IBEP's funding, there was no research. Nothing happened.
Okay. I'm sorry, were you... Didn't want to cut you off in the middle of a point. Was that the last that you had?
If
you have one more point, why don't you make it? We've given you additional
time. I do have one more point, and then I will sit down.
All right.
As Randolph said, or Rudolph said, that the Rubinstein invention was wholly outside of the sub-R&D agreement. Again, I would refer the court to Wallach's memo laying out the contributions of the inventors. I think that's at 4149, I believe, where he specifically talks about all that was done before Rubinstein joined the project, and as a result, Rubinstein was entitled to just a very small royalty percentage. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank both, well, all three. All four, counsel. And the case is submitted.
All rise.